The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
And welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, we'll talk to one bull who is sticking to his guns. Doubts are once again swirling about the prospects for a U.S.-China trade deal ahead of the upcoming December 15th tariff deadline. But according to a veteran stock market strategist, the signals hint that the longest ever bull market can keep on running.
And of course, we'll close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. And Sarah, I'm excited. We got another call to the What Goes Up hotline with a crazy thing a listener saw in markets.
We did. And he's actually a second time caller. So we'll definitely play that message later on in the show. And remember, if you have any crazy things that you've seen in markets or if you have questions that we want to acknowledge on the show, please feel free to give us a call. That number is 646-324-3490, and we may even play your message on the show.
Sarah, I wanted to give the listeners a little taste of how people like you and I do our normal day job as stocks reporters, markets reporters. Probably no big secret, but one of the first things I do every morning when I get in is I look through my emails. There's usually about 800 that came in overnight.
Yep.
But I always search for the word strategy to see what all the strategists on Wall Street are writing about. And you know, the big banks, you might be lucky to get a note or two a week. But there's one guy who I could count on every morning there. And his name's Jeff Sout. And I like reading his notes, not only because it's good market analysis and kind of a mix of fundamentals and technicals, but also very well written stuff. So entertaining to read. So very happy to welcome him here to the show. Jeff, welcome to the show.
You need to raise your standards.
We'll see what email he's reading tomorrow morning.
All right. Well, maybe we'll raise him a little bit with our other guest. One of the nicest guys in the building, I think. Real mentor to me. Brilliant broadcaster.
That just
writer.
Means I'm old.
And that voice you may recognize, that's Pim Fox, who's one of our commentators on the Markets Live blog here at Pim, and a guy who sits right behind me. So we got a lot to talk about, Pim. How you doing?
Yeah, I ask you a lot of questions that I can't answer all day long.
Well, that's now we'll get to ask you a lot of questions.
Yeah, clearly, I knew this was going to happen. Yes. Contradictions abound.
All right, Jeff, you were with Raymond James for a long time, but you're off to a new adventure now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've got going on now?
Well, I tried to retire 8 months ago, and it basically lasted 3 weeks. I've been writing a SOT strategy report for 48 years, almost 49 years, and there was such a demand for it that we created an LLC and had a website built, and a SOT strategy, www.sotstrategy.com, is a subscription service. And for some reason or another, these people at Capital Wealth Planning wanted me to, I'm really a consultant to them, because if I was an employee, they would have to approve everything I write for SOT Strategy, which, you know, 2 to 3 day turnaround is a lifetime in this business. So I'm a consultant to them, and I'm helping to manage $1.7 billion.
Not too shabby.
3 weeks is a pretty short retirement.
You got that right.
You came back very quickly.
So, Jeff, as Sarah had pointed out, your last note, you're remaining pretty bullish about this market. Now, I know you like to look at it sort of a mix of technicals and fundamentals. Walk us through your thinking on, you know, we've had this tremendous rally in the stock market. same time, the economic data got a little soft there. Maybe it's bottoming. Maybe not.
It has bottomed.
Yeah, you think so? So is that the reason to be bullish, basically? I mean, obviously, it would be a good reason to be bullish.
Well, Ron Barron, a few years ago, I was coming back from being on a panel at Tiburon down at the Ritz-Carlton downtown, and he gave me a ride up the FDR because I was going to the GM building, which is where Barron Capital is. And he put his hand on my shoulder halfway through it, and he said, you know, there's not many of us left. And I went, excuse me? He said, there's not many of us left that have seen a secular bull market. So the people that say this is the longest bull market in history don't know market history, because the 1949 to 1966 secular bull market had a number of 20 and 30%. 20% decline doesn't end a secular bull market. You had the Jack Kennedy steel crisis in 1962, where the steel companies raised prices and the president said, no, you got to put them back down. And the markets didn't like that. And they got hit for 30%. But the secular bull market went on for another 4 years. In the 82 to 2000 secular bull market, you had the 87 crash, which I was actually in Barron's on September 26th of 87, saying the utilities peaked in the spring, the trannies peaked in the summer, and we're going to get a waterfall decline. I didn't know to call it a crash because I ain't never seen a crash. I have now. And, you know, you had the crash, 22.6% in a day, but the secular bull market went on for another 13 years. So I think we're in a secular bull market. They last 15 to 20 years, and there's not many of us left around that have seen one.
So for those people who are out there saying that we're late cycle and maybe have been saying that we're late cycle for years, what would be your rebuttal back to them?
My rebuttal back to that is the downturn was so severe and the recovery so muted that what you've done is elongate mid-cycle. We're still in mid-cycle, in my opinion. We're not late cycle. And if you look at the stocks that are performing, it will tell you we're not late cycle.
So what would what sort of signals would make you start thinking the cycle is getting late?
Well, my dad was in the business, and he used to tell me, son, if you think it's going up, be bullish. If you think it's going down, be bearish. But for gosh sakes, make a call, because there's so many people in this business that talk out of both sides of their mouths so that no matter what the markets do, they can say, see, I told you so. And if you make calls, you're going to be wrong. And you're going to be wrong more often than you think. And the trick in this business is to be wrong quickly for a de minimis loss of capital. I got no problem at 70 years of age saying, hey, that was a bad call. I'm reversing my... So I'm not a broken clock bull. There's very few people. My friend Dick Russell passed away a number of years ago. He was the last great keeper of Dow Theory. And Dow Theory is not always right. It's subject to interpretation. But there was a Dow Theory sell signal on September 23rd in 1999. I wrote about it, raised 40% cash. There was a Dow Theory buy signal in June of 2003. There was a Dow Theory sell signal in November of 2007. And then the majority of stocks bottomed on October 10th of 2008. 92.6% of stocks traded made new annual lows on October. I've never seen that. That's a 7 or 8 standard deviation event. It is not supposed to happen in your lifetime. And I'm in print after being bearish from November of 2007. I'm saying the bottoming process has started. And on March 2nd, I'm on Bloomberg with Barton Biggs, March 2nd of 2009, saying the bottoming process that started in October of last year is complete this week, and we're all in.
So I know Dow Theory involves the transportation average, sort of have to
confirm the Dow.
Confirming the Dow. So how are you looking at that now? I mean, trannies aren't at a record right now, I don't think.
No, they're not. But they did make a new reaction high. And according to Dow Theory, the primary trend of the market is up. And the most important thing in analyzing markets is, what is the primary trend? Is it up or down? Well, the primary trend is up.
So alongside transports, some other areas of the market that I've heard other strategists, investors talk about as needing to confirm the market size have been the likes of small caps. And I know a couple weeks ago, back in November, you did write about a so-called golden cross in the Russell 2000. So I was hoping that you could explain to our listeners what exactly it is and what actually that means. Does that mean we could see more future gains or even small caps leading going forwards?
On November 5th, you had, and the golden cross is not as predictive for the S&P as it is for the Russell. It's much more predictive for the Russell 2000. And it occurred on November 5th, and it's when the 50-day moving average crosses above the 200-day moving average. And the small caps have performed pretty well since then. And it's not just the U.S. The European small cap indices had a golden cross on October 28th. So it's kind of this concerted move by the small caps, which have lagged, by the way. They've lagged for all this year, and now they're coming to the fore.
Pip, I want to bring you in on this a little bit, too. You know, obviously,
I was going to be contrary in all this. I was going to say, ask Jeff, of those small caps in the Russell 2000, how many of them are actually profitable?
I don't know the answer to that, but that's a great question.
Not many.
And the reason I ask it in that format is because I was under the impression that earnings and economic performance would eventually drive stock prices.
I agree with that.
So why do we have such a tepid economy? We got great numbers for employment. We got great numbers if you want to borrow money. But the economy is not growing. And in fact, you know, if you take a look at real inflation, what people really have to pay for things, you know, we are at a negative real rate of return for, let's say, treasuries. So is that what drives people putting money into equities? What underpins the market strength?
Well, I would argue that the individual investors, for the most part, are not putting money in equities. They're not just cautious. They're scared to
death. They're buying bonds.
Yeah, which I think is a bad trade, by the way. I think there's a ton of money on the sidelines. I think before it's over, this is not the way bull markets end. You've been around.
No, but I'm not talking about necessarily a bull market. I'm trying to look at the connection between the performance of the economy and the global economy, if you want to add to it, and the performance of equities, because this seems to be the most unloved bull market I can remember. We have stocks. Total return for the S&P 500 year to date is 26.5%. That's total return. So it's got dividends and so on. Why aren't you seeing anybody happy? It sort of belies the actual performance of their portfolios.
Yeah, and that's why you should continue to be bullish. If you remember 98 and 99 in the spring of 2000, everybody was happy.
So the wall of worry still exists.
Absolutely. And I would say that the anticipation of future earnings, I'm long a company called Zymeworks, Z-Y-M-E, at 20 and 24, and they may have the magic bullet for cancer. And the stock has gone from $20 to $44 in 6 months, and they're not making any money.
Yeah, but that you can make the argument, right? I mean, Sarah and Mike, you've written about this kind of stuff before, where you have binary events specifically with the pharmaceutical industry, right? I mean, a drug gets approved or unapproved, you know, it doesn't perform, and then
it makes or breaks the carpet.
Yeah, I think there's a million of them in the small cap. Yeah, there's a huge number of small biotechs.
Exactly. Yes.
We have a Fed meeting come next week. Most people don't really expect the Federal Reserve to do all of that much, change anything. But Jeff, when you look at asset prices across the board and you try to conduct your analysis, how much do you take into account what the Fed is actually doing?
Well, I think the Fed has been one of the drivers of stocks. And I don't think interest rates are going up in the near term. I think they're going to stay lower for longer than people think. And my work suggests that a fair market multiple in this interest rate environment on the S&P is somewhere between 19 and 20 times earnings. And if you want to use Ed Yardeni's $177 for next year and put a 20 multiple on that, talking 3,600 on the S&P.
You know, when you talk about the Fed and the balance sheets, I mean, obviously, what are they buying? The Fed now is buying.
Well, the Fed's buying almost, you know, name a debt instrument that a central bank around the world is not buying. And you look at the Bank of Japan, they're buying ETFs.
Well, I mean, that's all on their balance sheet. The Fed, what it's really buying now is the short end of the Treasury curve. Because we have this $1 trillion deficit, we've got massive issuance of treasuries, same story next year for the foreseeable future. Is that ever going to turn around and bite us, Jeff?
I don't think so. As I said, I think interest rates are going to stay lower for longer than people think. Yeah. And I think that with the millennials are doing in their 30s what the boomers did in their 20s, and they're buying homes, and they're eventually going to shove money at equities, which they haven't really done yet, but it's coming. It's coming. And that's going to be a huge tailwind for the equity markets as well.
We've gotten through this conversation, the bulk of it, without mentioning U.S. and China trade negotiations, which I must say I really respect. But Pim, I know you've been paying a lot of attention
to
the ongoings this week. You can't miss it. So why don't you
It's kind of
give
a whiplash. It's a whiplash market, right? Because you know you sit looking at the screen and you can basically tell when a tweet has been put out there by the president or by member of his administration talking about trade one way or another, and so goes the market, supposedly. But what I did was I took a look at the S&P 500, and I looked at all the companies in there, and I put together a model portfolio of 12 companies. They're all in the tech sector. And these 12 companies have between 30 and 65% of their revenue in China, right? We've heard all about, as you said, trade wars. So what I did was I tried to see, okay, so how did these stocks actually perform? Well, if you had bought them at the beginning of the year, you would have made 45% on your money. So compare that to the S&P 500 at 26.5%, you would have made 45% investing in these 12 companies. So then I went back and I said, well, okay, so maybe this is just an anomaly because it's just one year. I went back to the end of 2016 after the election, because the rhetoric from candidate Trump is pretty much the same as the rhetoric and the action of President Trump. You would have made even more. You would have made about 85% on your money. And the reason that I came up with is because it's not about trade. This trade war, I believe, is going to be a footnote. It's about the big pattern changes in trade having to do with Asia. You're looking at 4.8 billion people in Asia by 2025. So you got 4.8. The U.S. economy, it's still going to be big, still going to be important, but it is a decreasing importance in global capital. So that was my take on trade.
Can I ask you to name a few of the companies that are in that portfolio?
Oh, yeah. AMD, for example.
Probably all the chip makers.
Yeah.
Chip makers. Also, small companies. I looked, for example, at Skyworks Solutions, not one of the 12 I looked at. But, I mean, they've got over 20% of their revenue coming from China. I think it just got an upgrade on Thursday. And the stock has really outperformed.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
In one of your notes, you did say, we expect earnings to rebound just like the economy. How much of a rebound is actually possible, though?
I think you're going to accelerate by the end of 2020 to 3% GDP growth. And I think earnings are going to follow along with that. And again, earnings are the mother's milk of secular bull markets. And, you know, it was Warren Buffett that said, in the short run, the stock market is a beauty contest. But in the long run, it's all about earnings. And that's absolutely correct.
I just want to ask you, having to do with that point, do you think that this is also going to raise commodity prices? Because if you have GDP growth that is around 3%, will that pull commodities higher as well?
Yeah, I think commodities are going to trade higher. I think they've suppressed the price of crude oil too long. I did see where Saudi Arabia is talking about 400,000 barrel cut. But I mean, if you go to China, okay, like 20 years ago, you went to China, all you saw was bicycles. Now you see is cars, and a lot of them are Buicks, which I don't understand. But it's the demand that's going up in India and China for gasoline and energy is immense.
Right. Well, that's a nice segue into another topic you touched on recently, and that's MLPs, the Master Limited Partnerships. Mainly, it's usually oil pipelines that convert to an MLP to get that preferential tax treatment. These stocks amaze me because every now and then you'll see one with a dividend yield or distribution yield of like 20%.
You know, not 20.
But double digits for—
The Alerian Index yields between 8 and 9%.
Right, right. But yet, you know, when you buy a dividend stock, you tend to like that safety. You expect that dividend to be stable, if not grow. MLPs, it's a whole nother situation. So walk us through how you think about MLPs specifically.
There's a big distinction between upstream MLPs and midstream MLPs. The best MLP portfolio manager I know is Eric Kaufman at VE Capital. And he told me 8 years ago, you don't want to own the upstreams. They have too much price sensitivity to crude oil. But the midstreams, because everybody, all the upstreams went bankrupt. And because of that, they sold the midstreams down. Now, you can think of midstream MLPs, master limited partnerships, as a transportation company without wheels, because you're exactly right, Mike. They own the pipes and they own the storage facilities. And they have long-term contracts with people like Chevron, Exxon, and they have distributions. The good ones have distributions anywhere from 6% to 8%. And the two best in the business are EPD and ET. Extraterrestrial.
And you like the midstream because they're sort of less sensitive to the price of oil.
They basically have no price sensitivity. They're sensitive to volumes. How much volume is coming through the pipes?
Right.
And what your listeners should know is that somewhere between 70 and 80% of that distribution is tax deferred. So if you're my age and you're looking for income, it makes a lot more sense to buy the midstreams, and they're cheap. They're the cheapest they've been in 20 years. And my daddy used to tell me, son, good things tend to happen to cheap stocks.
Right. So it doesn't matter what the price of oil is, because if you need to transport it, you have to transport it somehow. You can't lie it sitting around.
Correct.
But speaking of the price of oil, Pim, I know you've done some work. I don't want to give any spoilers out, but you've got an outlook
piece coming out for crude oil. That's all right. It has to, well, it, basically, it just has to do with, we got a lot of crude oil.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jeff mentioning the pipeline system, for example, it has basically been reversed, right? There used to be that we would import oil, we would process it down on the Gulf Coast, and then it would be shipped north, east, west, wherever, to consumers in the United States. Well, there's so much oil in the United States, those pipelines have had to be reversed. And now the oil's going down to the Gulf Coast and it's being exported. Now, it's not and being exported in the form of crude, but also in the form of LNG, liquefied natural gas. And that is proven to be a big market. But like any big capital intensive industry, you got to beware, because what happens is there's demand, people see it. So what do? They build huge supply opportunities, right? Whether that is in a liquefaction plant or building more pipelines or building too many ships. And it's just what happens in the mining industry. That's why I was interested in what happens to the commodity complex, because unless you get commodity prices to move higher, a lot of these projects, they're very expensive, first of all. They are not going to be profitable. And you're seeing that with some attempts to shut in production in the Permian and in various shale plays of the United States because they can't get it to a market that can pay for it. In fact, I think there was a story that natural gas was actually, the producers were actually paying people to take the natural gas away because they couldn't flare it and they couldn't sell it.
Right.
Yeah, so the Henry Hub's full.
Correct. Exactly. It's full. And so, you know, when you look at oil, as Jeff alluded to, you have the OPEC oil cartel, which is trying to manage price by decreasing production. The only problem with that is you have countries like Russia, like Nigeria, who need the oil. I mean, they need the revenue, right? That's hard currency for them. Well, what else are you going to sell?
Right.
So I think that push-pull is going to continue. Go ahead.
So we've had this range
maybe
West Texas, 55 to 60.
60, yeah, which is where we
are. Are we just stuck in that for the foreseeable future?
I would think so. I would think that, you know, it's pretty range-bound, because anytime the price starts to go up, what you're going to do is you're going to see producers in the United States who have got big debt on their balance sheet. They're going to start to produce as much mm-hmm. as possible, and the U.S. is the swing producer. I think the U.S. now produces 15% of the world's oil.
That's right.
That is amazing.
Imagine that 50 years back.
All going through Jeff's midstream MLPs, I guess.
as long as the tax law stays the same.
Yeah, that's right.
And that is a footnote just to mention with the MLPs, because there was a lot of issue having to do with getting rid of that sort of real estate investment trust-like pass-through of income.
What if Elizabeth Warren comes in and bans fracking?
Not a snowball's chance in hell.
Why do you say that?
Did you hear what Kamala Harris said a week ago? She said that when I'm president, of course she's out now, but when I'm president, I'm going to make all the pharmaceutical companies roll back drug prices, and if they don't do it, we're going to confiscate all their patents, and the government's going to own them. And I'm going, excuse me? You hear about constitutional law or law in general?
I was going to say, how do you go long lawyers?
Move to Washington, D.C.
Ah, well done. Well done.
Well, if we're talking about lawyers, I think it's officially time for the craziest things segment of the show. Sarah, I believe we got a call to the hotline. What, tell us about that.
We did. We got a second time caller. His name is Morgan Hill, and he is an investment associate in South Florida. So take a listen.
Weird event that happened. I saw Petra Diamonds, which is struggling from a lot of debt and falling diamond prices, recently sold a 20-carat blue gem essentially for like $15 million. Never knew that 20-carat a diamond could be sold for that much, but it happened. So crazy thing that happened in the market recently.
Gotta say, it was a good one, but he took a page out of your book from Esoteric Markets.
That's true. That's true. $15 million blue diamond. Jeff, is your wife getting a special present this
No, she's
this?
Got the diamond I gave her 50 years ago when it was like $500.
Imagine what it would be worth now.
That's what I was going to mention, is that just be mindful. What you mentioned is very important. It's a blue diamond, colored diamonds. Colored precious stones are increasing in value and are rare. On the other hand, sorry, Jeff, regular diamonds, on the other hand, they are falling in price.
Really?
And yes. And there are just too many of them. And De Beers and the old cartel that used to control them.
That's right.
They are losing their grip.
That's right.
All right, Sarah, can you top a 15... Was it $15 million?
Yeah, $15 million.
Blue diamond. I challenge you to top that as the craziest thing you saw this week.
I will admit offhand that this is a bit of a stretch because it's not necessarily something that happened in markets, but it does pertain to a certain CEO of one company, and that is David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs. So Amazon was having one of their big cloud conferences, and it turns out that, yes, David Solomon is a DJ. He often DJs at different events around the country, sometimes in the summer out at the Hamptons. He's DJed before. I know Bloomberg has covered it before. But he DJed at this Amazon cloud event. But the really crazy part was that supposedly a lot of people had no idea who he was. They didn't recognize him. So they were like, who's this guy on stage DJing? Turns out, CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Hey, look, whatever it takes to get Amazon as your client, I guess.
He came out afterwards in a suit and talked about how important AWS is to his business.
Jeff, did they tell you about our gimmick, the craziest thing in markets this week?
The craziest thing I saw in the past 2 weeks was Kamala Harris saying she's going to confiscate all the patents that Merck and Pfizer have.
Did we see any of the companies react?
No.
I don't remember.
It's nonplussed. Yeah. That's why she dropped out.
Pim, how about you? You see anything crazy?
I don't know if it's crazy or not, but if you take a look at the SOX, right, which is the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, and then you also take a look at the Philadelphia Gold and Silver Miners Index, you'd think they would diverge, right? Because you buy gold and silver, talk about diamonds and so on. You buy those as a hedge, a haven, right? You stick those away. Actually, they both outperform the S&P 500, and it just... You know, the look at the gold miners, that moves in opposite lockstep, interest rates. It has nothing to do with anything else. And so this idea that you have these havens, these divergences, I got to say, it's a different market now.
It was a crazy year in markets in that it was truly an everything rally. The havens rallied, treasuries, gold, everything rallied. I mean, EM debt.
And yet no one seemed to like it.
Right. Gold and TLT both up roughly 14%. The S&P up around 25%. You look at oil up an immense amount, really everything higher
this
year.
The reciprocal of that is in 2008, everything went down.
Right.
There was nowhere to hide except cash.
Right. Right.
Quite
right.
The difference.
Well, and then even the reserve fund broke at the buck. So so even that wasn't a sure bet. Well, I'm going to talk about, for my crazy thing, a stock that most certainly did not rally this week, and that is Peloton. I don't know. If, I'm sure listeners have probably already heard this. But
you're going to climb on your bike about that, huh?
For those who haven't, you know, obviously the goal of buying a big ad, placing a big ad budget in the market is to boost sales, boost your stock. Didn't work out so well for Peloton this week.
The adverse effect.
Right. So they had this ad where a woman gets a Peloton bike from her husband for Christmas. She's very excited about
exercise
it.
Bike, right?
The basically an iPad attached to it that you can watch the classes, and she goes gung-ho on Peloton for a year, and the internet, I think, Sarah, the word these days is they just canceled Peloton over this. As a husband, I'm kind of at a loss. I think the only solution is not to get your wife anything.
Look, I'll be completely honest. I didn't really see the issue in it. Sure, you could look at the ad as being, I don't know, maybe a bit strange, but hey, if someone got me a Peloton, I would be psyched. I'd be really happy about it. I don't think I would be offended that someone was telling me or hinting.
At my house, it would become a clothes rack.
Right, right, a $2,000
just hang something on everything.
I do have a theory that the guy, whoever bought that $15 million diamond, is a guy who bought his wife a Peloton last Christmas. Do you think that's... There's a good chance of that.
Very good, Mike. Very good. You sound like you speak from experience.
Conspiracy theories abound from Mike Regan. But with that said, Jeff Sout, Pim Fox, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's a pleasure.
Great to be here.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is Reganonymous, and Pim Fox is at Pim Fox. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.